offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. As always, joining you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilam, this is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai. And this is a program where we together learn and try to understand the import of one of the most profound works of Sanatana Dharma that Swami has spoken so highly of, Swami has spoken so often of, the Bhagavad Gita. And we call this a triune pilgrimage because it is a beautiful synthesis of all the three paths that we often talk of bhakti, karma and jnana. And we are in the second chapter and we are actually completing the second chapter today. Towards the end of the program today, of course, I will tell you a small quip of what Swami says about the second chapter in the Gita Vahini, and that will probably seal it for how important this particular chapter is. We've taken quite a while to complete it because, of course, it has many shlokas. Today is going to be the 72nd shloka which we'll complete. So there are so many shlokas, but it is in a capsule form what Krishna says in the rest of the Gita, and that's why it's a very important chapter, and we've given it fair amount of time that it calls for because of how important this particular chapter is. I'm very grateful to all of you who have joined me week after week in this journey, and definitely, as I always say, it's thanks to listeners that I have this opportunity to go back into this beautiful work and study it in detail, and I'm ever grateful to you and I'm ever grateful to Swami who's given me this opportunity. So thanking Swami for that, let's begin this week's concluding episode of the second chapter. It's not the concluding episode of the Gita series, of the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. As always, let's start with a short recap of what we did last week. We covered four verses last week, 66, 67, 68 and 69. In verse 66, Krishna had established a link between self-control, which is something that he's been talking of, and a contemplative nature. But before that, he says that there is no means of attaining wisdom or buddhi for one who has no self-control, right? The word for a person without self-control that he uses is an ayukta. So he says for an ayukta, there is no means of attaining that buddhi or that ultimate wisdom. But he also goes on to add that there is no meditative contemplation for one who doesn't have that sort of self-control. We discussed how it is so. You know, why does Krishna make this statement? For being contemplative, we must understandably give a break to the senses that are constantly going outward, because contemplation is always drawing yourself within, and that can never be possible when the senses are constantly running outward. So a certain amount of self-control is understandably necessary. Also, to be contemplative, as we discussed last time, the ability to be in solitude is very, very essential, right? And for that, one needs to be, at least to a certain extent, happy or contented with oneself. And when we have excessive desires, it only makes us feel inadequate, right? We feel that what I am right now, minus the desires that I crave for, makes me an incomplete person. That makes you uncomfortable in your own company. And that is why to be even in a certain amount of solitude, to be able to contemplate, you need to have a certain amount of contentment. That becomes very, very important. And without a contemplative and a meditative nature, one cannot attain peace, is what Krishna says. And without peace, where is the question of happiness? And that's how verse number 66 ends. The 67th verse, again, has a very beautiful analogy. We have come across many analogies. We're going to come across another beautiful analogy today too. So in this particular verse, number 67, Krishna says that if the mind is constantly following the wandering senses, it will carry away the discrimination in man, the buddhi in man, like a sailboat is carried away by the wind. The beauty of this analogy, as we had discussed last week, is that the same wind that can carry away the sailboat is also used to navigate the same boat. And that can be possible only if the person sitting in the boat has control over the sail, right? Similarly, the same mind that when it is going after the wandering senses can carry away the buddhi, if controlled, if marshaled well, the same mind will have the ability to take one to the doorstep of the ultimate destination, right? That's the beauty of that particular analogy. Going to verse number 68, there Krishna more or less summarizes these points and says that the person, a person of such a nature, his wisdom is steady, whose senses are completely withdrawn from the sense objects, which means we've repeated this and discussed this any number of times, where what is the meaning of control? Control does not necessarily mean completely withdrawing from the senses. And even when Krishna says here, one whose senses are completely withdrawn, which means the person who is wielding the senses is in complete control of the senses. There is no amount of dragging of the senses by the sense objects. And the verse that we will go through today will also emphasize on this. It is not necessary that a person of such nature is completely away from all of these senses and objects of the senses. But it means something more. We'll come to that in a short while. In the verse number 69 that we concluded, it's a very beautiful and cryptic verse, as we discussed last time. Krishna says the Samyami, or the one who has such control over the mind and has wisdom, for him it is day when it is night for all, and when it is day for all, it is night for him. And this is how Krishna puts it, a very beautiful verse. And we discussed what this really means, that when it comes to matters of knowledge, when it comes to matters of wisdom, those who are worldly are really in dark. They have no clue of what this person is talking about, what this exposition is all about. They are completely unaware of those concepts. But the jnani is very much aware in these topics and in the foray into the world of jnana. When Krishna later says that for him it is night when others are awake, here the analogy of sleep is not that one of ignorance. In the previous analogy or the previous comparison, sleep was being literally equated to ignorance. But here when he talks of sleep, he is equating it to a nature where one is not disturbed by the aberrations that are happening outside. Because if we were to analyze what sleep is all about, it is about the senses being withdrawn into the mind, and for that brief time, whatever happens around the person is unaware of it, untouched by it. So when Krishna says that for a jnani, it is night when it is day for everybody else, the worldly, their alertness is piqued when something of interest is in front of them. And when we say something of interest, these are objects of the senses, objects of the desires. So they are alerted and awakened when something is in front of them of that sort. But for a person of deep wisdom, for him it is like he is in deep sleep where the senses are completely withdrawn. Right? So that was the analogy or the explanation of the analogy that Krishna gives in verse number 69. So those were the verses that we covered last time, 66, 67, 68, and 69. We have three more verses to complete the second chapter, which I think we should be able to do. We should be able to cover it in the given time. So as always, we'll go to listening to the verse. It is rendered by Brother Shyam, one of our alumnus. We'll listen to it in his voice. After that, I'll give you a brief meaning of that particular verse, and then we will take it word by word and we will discuss it.
आपूर्यमाणमचल प्रतिष्ठम् समुद्रमापः प्रविशन्ति यद्वत् तद्वत् कामायम् प्रविशन्ति सर्वे स शान्तिमाप्नोति न कामकामी.
Just as waters enter into the ocean, which is filled continuously and which is unruffled, in the same way, he into whom all objects of desire enter, he attains peace, not he who longs for the objects of desire. A as I mentioned, again, a very, very beautiful analogy, even in this particular verse. If you look at the Upanishads, the Vedantic texts, they always take recourse in these kind of analogies and parallels. Why is it so? These texts, the Vedanta, always is trying to teach us a knowledge which is not regular or which is not common. You need to look keenly to understand these concepts, right? If we go on with life as we always do, as we are going right now, we are quite likely to miss some of these knowledges, and that is why this particular knowledge, the knowledge which Vedanta always speaks about, is referred to as paravidya, or knowledge which is transcendental, right? And in comparison to that, the worldly knowledge is referred to as aparavidya, that which is not transcendental knowledge, if you could put it that way. So it is called paravidya, which means para, the word itself means that which is beyond, right? It is not directly available for a simple common thinking mind, right? And that is why it is not very easy to grasp. So if I were to tell you something which is related to the world, if I tell you that, look, this is water and this is fire, this is the mountain, this is the river, it is easy to understand those concepts because they are right in front of me. There are some concepts which are a little more difficult, which are a little more intellectual, but with a little bit of effort, you're able to understand that. But if I were to tell you that, you know, this is the water, this is the fire, and this is the space, and all these are divine, all these are Brahman, that is not something which is easily understandable to me. Or if I tell you that, you know, you're a separate person, I'm a separate person, but this separateness or this distinct nature is an illusion, it is Maya, that is not something which is easily understandable. A mind has to be prepared for that. The mind has to be taken along a certain kind of explanation, right? And that is why the Upanishads, which deal with what we refer to as paravidya, always take recourse to the tools of analogies and explanations like this. They are sometimes even called upayas, or means by which a certain knowledge is passed on, right? The Upanishads always talk about paravidya, but it is very important to keep in mind that the Upanishads themselves say that paravidya and aparavidya is very important. Both spiritual and secular knowledge is important. But secular knowledge, in the absence of spiritual knowledge, becomes useless and in some cases even dangerous, right? So it is not that worldly knowledge is not good, but it is very important to have paravidya. And that is why what the Upanishads do is they get into understandings that we already have. They take examples which are all around us, like in this case, in the example of an ocean. There's an example that we saw last week of a boat being carried away. Or we had the analogy of a tortoise which draws its limbs inside itself. All of these are images and experiences that we have seen. So it makes a reference to something that is known or seen or understood already, and tries to expand that understanding to paravidya, which is not otherwise directly understandable, right? And one of the most classic analogies which Vedanta takes recourse to is the analogy of the ocean, of saying that, the Paramatma or the Brahman represents the ocean and the waves represent the individual or the Jivatma, right? This is an analogy which is oft used, because again, this is something which is so easily available in front of us, right? Though we have given this name for this formation called a wave, we have given it a name, we know it as a form, but we do not for a moment ever think that the wave is separate from the ocean, right? So that's right in front of us. So an experience or a vision which is so easily accessible to us is taken to explain a higher truth. But for now, let's forget the idea of the wave, because in this particular verse, Krishna is only talking about the ocean, right? And he speaks of the ocean, the nature of the ocean, as similar to the nation or the nature of the sthita prajna. What does he say? Krishna goes on to say, yadvat, just as samudram, the ocean, apuryamanam, remains filled to the brim, achala pratishtam, remains undisturbed or unmoved, apaha pravishanti, when water enters. He uses two very beautiful adjectives to describe the ocean. He says apuryamanam, which means it is always filled, it is always, you know, brimming, right? And that's what it says, apuryamanam. It is always full by itself, and it is achala pratishtam. It is unmoved, undisturbed, right? So those are the two analogies he uses, and he says that apaha pravishanti, even though the waters enter from all sides, the rivers come and merge into the ocean, but the nature of the ocean, of it being always full and always undisturbed, does not change because of these waters coming in, right? The rivers and streams constantly flow into the ocean, but the ocean is never dependent on the rivers. If you look at it, the clouds depend on the ocean for its waters. The rivers and ponds depend on the clouds for their waters. But the ocean is already full. It is not craving for the rivers to come and fill it, right? That's the nature of the ocean. And when the waters do eventually empty into it, the ocean does not swell because of the waters coming in. The ocean still remains, right? That is why Krishna uses the word achala pratishtam. These rivers come and fill it, but it does not change its nature of already being full or being stable. But we might raise this question of, but, you know, how can we say that the ocean is always still? We know that tsunamis happen. We know that the waves can become really, really rough. And we've all been to beaches and we've seen the restlessness of the ocean and the sea. How can we say that the ocean is achala pratishtam? It does not move. The explanation that I'm going to give is definitely not based on facts of oceanography, but just if you look at it merely by the observance of what we've seen of the ocean or whatever we've seen of documentaries of how the ocean is, if you look at it, compared to the vastness of the ocean, the waves that are there only where the ocean comes in contact with the shore seems to be very, very less in quantity and magnitude. If you look at the ocean, it is completely vast. And if you're talking about the depths of the ocean, the restlessness that is seen in the surface is comparatively minuscule, right? The wave itself, which we are talking about as being rough or raising and falling, that has a very, very brief existence, right? But for that brief time that the wave exists, the wave has a name and a form. We've called it a wave and it has a particular form, right? And then seamlessly it merges back into the ocean. And that is why there's always this comparison of the ocean being the Brahman or Paramatma and these waves being the Jivatma, right? So similarly, the Jiva or the individual soul appears to be an individual with a distinct name and form. But compared to the eternal existence of the soul, this name form existence is very, very brief, right? So just like how the wave rises and then falls back into the ocean and merges, similarly, the Jivatma has a very brief existence compared to the Brahman, and for a very brief time assumes a name and a form and then merges back. And we are looking at it only in that brief moment when it has a distinct name and form, right? So similarly, when we say the ocean, it is a reference to the vastness of the ocean, the stillness of its depths, not to the waves that come and go. The waves that have a very brief existence cannot define the ocean. The ocean's true nature is its vastness and its depth, isn't it? So we all are like those waves that think that for that brief time the wave is there. Imagine a wave thinks that I am different. I am different from the rest. And then comes the comparison. One wave says that I'm bigger than you, or the other wave says, see, I have so many waves that are rising along with me, right? That individuality comes, if you can imagine a wave for a moment getting that ahankara and feeling that I am separate from the ocean, right? And when one identifies with the ocean, when the wave merges back into the ocean or identifies with the ocean, that is the state of what Krishna is referring to here, where the individual self merges into the vast nature of the eternal self. So Arjuna had asked Krishna about the state of prajna, right? That's how all of this conversation is happening. And Krishna says he is like the ocean, which means he does not identify with the restlessness of the waves. He is not like a small pond or reservoir that depends on groundwater or rain or for the rivers to fill it. He knows that he is the ocean. He knows that he is the source of all happiness and joy. And when he is in such a state, objects of desire do not unsettle him. So it is a way of saying that all of us are actually the ocean, right? All of us, whether we agree or not, we imagine ourselves to be a wave, but we still are part of the ocean. But Sthita Prajna has recognized his oneness with the ocean, right? That's why Krishna is saying the Sthita Prajna is like an ocean. But the specific analogy that Krishna is using here is, he says that just like how the ocean does not be affected by the rivers which come into it, the Sthita Prajna is not affected by the objects of the senses that are around him. He may still be utilizing the objects of senses and desires. It may still be coming his way. He might be appearing to be using all of these things, but he is not going to be craving for it, or he is not going to be feeling bad when it leaves. So that is why Krishna says here, Apuryamanam achala pratishtam samudramapaha pravishanti yadvat. Just as the ocean remains full and unmoved, even as the waters, he says, tadvat, even so, sashantim apnoti, he attains supreme peace. Who? Kamayam pravishanti sarve, into whom desires enter from all directions, like the waters enter the ocean without being able to disturb it. Right? So here, of course, the word kama, I translated it as desire, but it is more appropriate to define it as the objects of the desires. So when he says kama yam pravishanti, when the objects of desires come into him or come past him, I mean, come into him is a more literal way of telling it, but he comes into contact with these objects of desires. In a worldly person, when he comes into contact with worldly objects, you know, when I see a brand new gadget, when I see a brand new car, when I see something like a beautiful house, these are objects of desires, and when I come in contact with them, they unsettle my nature, right? They make me crave for it. They make me want it. They make me want to do something about getting it, right? So when we come in contact with objects of the desires, we have desires arising in us, right? So when he says, kama yam pravishanti sarve, the objects of desires are all around him, and he might even appear to be using some of these objects, but they do not disturb him. They do not create a craving in him. And how do you know that they do not create a craving in him? When they leave or when they are taken away, it does not disturb him, right? That's why Krishna says he is like the ocean which does not depend on the rivers. Even though the river does come and empty into it, it does not mean that the rivers don't come. The rivers might come, the rivers might not come, but the ocean remains full. The ocean remains always steady, apuryamanam and achala pratishtam. And then Krishna completes that verse. He says, na kama kami. The whole explanation that he said the person described above will eventually reach the ultimate peace, but not a kama kami, one who desires for objects of desires. The comparison is that, he says, the one who is like the ocean, the objects of desires come in front of him, but they are unable to disturb him. But a kama kami means when a kama, an object of desire, comes in front of him, he becomes a kami. He becomes one who is desirous of that object. So for a kama kami, this shanti is not available. This peace is not available. The next verse, which is verse number 71, is more or less a simplification of whatever Krishna said in the form of an analogy in this verse. And also he adds another part, which I've already mentioned, but we'll discuss about it. First, we'll listen to the verse. I'll give you the meaning after that, and then we'll discuss that.
Vihaya kaman yas sarvan pumamscharati nispruhaha nirmamo nirahankaraha sashanti madhigacchati.
That man attains peace who, after rejecting all desires, moves about free from hankering, without the idea of mine and devoid of pride. So Krishna ends this verse with Sashantim Adhigachati. He attains Shanti. So who attains Shanti? He says, Vihaya Kamanyaha Sarvan. He who has given up all desires. Pumamscharati Nispruhaha. This person moves about without any craving. Right? This is what was described in the form of the analogy of the ocean. But he makes it very clear here. Vihaya Kamanyaha Sarvan. He has given up all desires and he moves about Nispruhaha, which means he is living in the world. He continues to use objects of the world. He continues probably to use the latest gadgets. He continues to live in a luxurious house. But he is not a Kamakami. He is not one who desires for these objects of the desires, and he does not get disturbed when they come or go. Right? Not only that, he goes on to add Nirmamo, without the sense of mind, Nirahankaraha, without the sense of ego or the limited individuality. So the first line is, as I said, a rephrasing of what Krishna said in the previous verse. He has given up all desires and he moves about the world unaffected by the cravings or without being drawn to these objects, even though they are all around him. But in the second line, he adds two more adjectives. He says, Nirmamo Nirahankaraha. He is without ahankara and mamakara, the feelings of I and mine. And this was the part I was mentioning about the wave, right? Whether the wave accepts it or not, it is certainly part of the ocean. But as long as it believes that it is only that individual wave, it will only relate to the restlessness of the wave. The ups and downs it is subjected to will disturb it, and it will say that, oh, I am small, this is what I am, right? But when the wave identifies with the ocean, it will identify with the vastness, with the completeness, and with the steadiness of the ocean. And as I mentioned earlier too, there are other kinds of people also who will probably fit into this description of being unaffected by the desires that are around, right? Someone who is, say, completely knocked off because of taking some intoxication or tranquilizer or something like that, or who is unconscious, or someone who is not in their senses because of any reason, or somebody like even a child who does not necessarily come to understand that these are all objects of desire, right? So even these people might be unaffected by these objects of desire coming in front of them. But these do not qualify to be a person of wisdom or to qualify to be called Stita Prajna, right? We are talking about Prajna Pratishta, the knowledge being firmly established. So the person must not be only detached from all of these objects, but he should also have wisdom, right? Why is this very, very important, and it keeps repeating again and again, and every time it comes, I also make a point to say this, because what is important is that pratishta, prajna pratishta, and even in the name Stita Prajna, the word Stita is very, very important, because, you know, today I am not affected by all of these things, but tomorrow if something more attractive comes, something that I have not seen before and I get fascinated, right? That possibility is always there. That is why Krishna always quickly completes his description. Whenever he's saying that he's not attracted to these objects of desires, he's not pulled by all of these, he always adds that that alone is not enough, right? Control of senses and being detached, not being affected by the objects, these are all merely expressions of being established in the wisdom. And what is that wisdom? Nirmamo nirhankaro. Not feeling the idea of mindness, looking at objects and seeing this is mine, this is my body. And being nirhankara, going beyond that individual idea, feeling that I am just this wave, right? But even a sense of body consciousness being lost in itself is not a complete description, right? That is again something that we spoke about last time. If we were to say that, oh, you just have to overcome this idea of body consciousness, I made a reference to Swami's discourse many times when he says that, oh, you can just take some intoxicant and even then you lose body consciousness, right? That is why this whole chapter or this whole part of the nature of Sthita Prajna, it might appear to us that these are all concepts which are constantly repeating, right? It is because it is very, very difficult to describe a jnani. Krishna has said so much in the description of Sthita Prajna, but when I, when you go through the second chapter, at least I felt it this way, that it appears that Krishna feels that his description of a jnani is not satisfactory to him, right? And he goes again and again and he says, no, he has control of senses, but he does not have only control of senses, he also has wisdom. Not only that he has wisdom which does not come and go. Not only he has wisdom like that, he is nirahankara, he has given up all the individual feeling. And then again he goes back to say that no, he should also not have desires and he should be like the ocean. The reason why I feel Krishna is repeating all of this and saying it from all these angles is because it is not easy to describe a person of such wisdom. And it is even more difficult to describe a person of such wisdom to a person who is stuck in the worldly path, right? Many times this occurs to me, and I'm sure those of you who have this duty of explaining some of these things to your children or a Balvika's teacher who's trying to tell this to their students. If you simply go to a youngster who's probably, you know, going through life like any normal youngster would and tell him or her, you know what, don't pursue what you like. Don't have any likes and dislikes. They will just, don't have any desires or control your senses. You should have ceiling on desires. I don't think they will be able to relate to that idea, right? Unless you really explain to them the background of what you're saying, like Krishna is saying here or like how Swami used to explain in his discourses. But if you just go and tell a person, I know you like this thing, but don't go after what you like because you should not have likes and dislikes. I am absolutely sure that that person will not be able to understand where you're coming from at all, right? And most of us have felt or would have felt when we were going through this description of the Sthita Prajna state, this looks like a description of a completely boring person, right? Oh, he will not be affected by this. Oh, he will not have craving for this. It looks like a description of a person who's probably going to be really, really boring. And how can a person be without any interest? How can a person be without any cravings or passions like that? You know, you can probably imagine somebody who's just sitting with his eyes closed and not doing anything, right? It's quite not unnatural to think like that, because it is not easy to understand the nature of a jnani without having an idea of what a jnani is. I'll tell you what I mean by that. When Arjuna is asking, you know, Krishna that question when he started off talking about the Sthita Prajna state, he says, how does he walk? How does he talk? Had Krishna answered that question just as Arjuna was asking, it would have made no sense to Arjuna, right? Swami would often give the example of King Janaka. King Janaka was a jnani. So what did Janaka do after he became a jnani? He did what he was always doing, right? He ruled his kingdom. He was a king. He was ruling a kingdom, right? And he became a jnani. That's why he's referred to as Raja Rishi. He becomes a jnani, but he continues to rule the kingdom of Mithila even after he became. So what does a jnani do? How does he sit? How does he talk? He continues to do what he always did. Then what has changed? Well, that is what Krishna has described so far. His inner mechanism completely changes. The ocean allows the river to empty itself in it, but the ocean is not dependent on the river. A jnani does not depend on the objects, does not depend on karma for his happiness, right? We are all dependent on our actions. We have to do something to attain something to be happy, right? He is the destination of a karma yogi. In in one sentence, if you were to say, sthita prajna is what is the destination of a karma yogi. A karma yogi takes up karma for the sake of purification of the mind, for chitta shuddhi, right? This is something which we discussed quite some time back. There are two ways of doing karma, pursuing raga and dvesha, or doing karma for chitta shuddhi. So a karma yogi takes up karma for chitta shuddhi. So the destination of a karma yogi is sthita prajna. A jnani is one who has attained that complete chitta shuddhi. So he doesn't have to do karma even for chitta shuddhi now, right? That's what it means. But he still acts. How can that act of a jnani be ever described? And even if it is described, it is close to impossible for people like you and me to understand. At least for me to understand, let me confess, I don't know if there are any jnanis listening, probably they will be able to understand. And that is why in the verse that we saw the last time, Krishna says, he refers to the jnani as a samyami. Yama means control of the senses. Samyami is one who has control of the senses and who is also wise, right? And when describing the samyami, Krishna says, what is daylight for him is what is darkness for everybody else, which means they live in completely different worlds. It is very difficult to understand the nature of a jnani. How it is impossible to describe or define light to a blind person. Someone who has been blind from birth, how can you describe in words what light is? It is close to impossible, right? And that is what is Krishna trying to do. He is trying to describe light to a blind person. He is trying to describe jnani, the nature of a jnani, to a worldly person, right? Of course, Arjuna is not an uninitiated worldly person also in that sense, but even then, that is the desperateness you can find in this entire chapter when Krishna tries to explain this from different directions, right? And each of the descriptions that Krishna gives is not complete in itself, right? That's why he talks about self-control, he talks about meditation, he talks about wisdom, he talks about having no idea of mamakaram. So all of this Krishna explains in all these varied ways, and the reason why he explains it in all these various ways is each one of those descriptions is a means to attain that state. If you want, you can start with self-control, or start by constantly contemplating on the truth, or start by doing your duty without expecting any results. Any one of this is not what makes a jnani, but through any of these means, you can reach the state of a jnani, right? So words can never do justice to the description of a jnani, and that is why probably Adi Shankara says in his very famous verse, the Viveka Chudamani, he says, Manushyatvam Mumukshatvam Mahapurusha Samshraya. He says these are the three blessings which are very, very rare to come by. Manushyatvam, he says, to be born a human being. To understand what a jnani is, first you have to be a human being, right? If it is difficult to explain what a jnani is to a human being, imagine explaining it to any other animal form or any other being, right? So the first blessing is to be born a human being. Thankfully, we all have that, right? Manushyatvam. The next is mumukshatvam, the desire to go beyond the worldly benefits that one gets, right? One is born a human being and one has that craving for moksha, or craving for something more than what the world is there to offer. It is easier to explain the nature of a jnani to a person who has that mumukshatvam, right? That is why probably Arjuna it is easier to explain, because he has mumukshatvam. He has asked these beautiful questions. So it is difficult to explain to a regular human being. It is a little more easier for somebody who's a mumukshu, who has the craving for moksha, and it becomes a little more easier to explain to somebody who has manushyatvam, mumukshatvam, and mahapurusha samshraya. Somebody who has had the opportunity to witness or live with a mahapurusha. Witness somebody who has the qualities of a jnani, right? That is the reason why Arjuna is asking this question. How does he talk? How does he speak? Because when you live with a jnani, You cannot see the workings of the mind so easily, but you will see how he sits, how he talks, how he carries himself, right? And probably when Krishna was giving all this description of Astita Prajna to Arjuna, probably Arjuna must have been trying to understand how does Astita Prajna carry himself. And he must be thinking that the example is right in front of me, right? He must be recapitulating Krishna's nature, because Krishna is an example of what a jnani is, right? And he must have been seeing, running in his mind, all of those experiences that he's had with Krishna, all of the events that have occurred in his life where Krishna has played a major role. And this is how he reacts, right? And how lucky we all are that we've had the opportunity to see such a personality in action, right? We've seen Swami in action, and we still have the opportunity to study the nature of Swami. And that is why Adi Shankara says, Mahapurusha Samshraya, it is impossible to describe the nature of a jnani, but if you live in the presence of a jnani, I am referring to Swami as a jnani, but it does not necessarily mean somebody who's gone through the stages of a jignasa and a mumukshu and then become a jnani. He is Yogishwara, right? Krishna is referred to as Yogishwara. Swami is Yogishwara, but I'm saying that the nature of a Astita Prajna, the nature of a jnani, you would be able to see. And it really is a wonder for me, and I'm sure anybody who has observed Swami will be able to vouch for this. How can somebody who is so detached be so enthusiastic? Right? Whenever we used to see Swami, that is the idea which would come. Swami is so aloof. Swami is so detached. He craves for nothing. He cares for nothing. But still, he would be bubbling with enthusiasm. Right? He would be so very vibrant that being teenagers and 20-year-olds, we could not match that. How is that? How is he so enthusiastic? Sometime back, I happened to see a video on online. I don't have the link to that, so please don't write to me asking for it. I just happened to see it, where Swami was actually performing the 60th Shashtipurti, right? The marriage which is performed when the husband completes 60 years. So this was an elderly devotee who's been with Swami for many, many years. So Swami was performing the Shashtipurti for this particular couple. It was unbelievable to see how joyful and enthusiastic Swami was. He was running all over the place, right? The couple were a little withdrawn, and they were looking a little calm, and I wouldn't say calm, probably tensed, right? You're in the presence of Swami, so, and you know, you've been devotees for so many years, and in front of all these devotees, you have to carry yourself with some self-restraint. But the joy that Swami was exuding was so very beautiful to watch. He was jumping from the stage down, he was running around, and he was posing for pictures. He was arranging the garlands on these people so that the pictures were coming out well, and running the whole show. How does somebody be so enthusiastic, right? See, if it is my parents' Shashtipurti, or if it is some event related to me, my child's birthday or my own birthday, it is understandable that me being excited about it. How can Swami be so enthusiastic about each and everyone's joy when he's actually beyond all of these joy and sorrow? So many times when Swami is being served something, or apparently when Swami is staying in Purnachandra Hall, or when Swami is staying in the Mandir, and Swami is being served lunch, Swami would look at an item and say, "Hey, keep aside this. You know, that boy likes this. You keep it aside for him. When he comes for lunch, you can serve it to him." How does one be so detached and yet be so involved? Right? And that is Astita Prajna. Astita Prajna cannot be a boring person. Anybody who has seen Swami will know that being a jnani is not being boring, but being full of life. And being full of life without any restraint, without any control, right? I remember on another occasion when Swami wanting to perform the 60th marriage anniversary of another couple, apparently Swami sent new clothes, a pair of silk dhoti and silk sari, to that particular couple so that they could wear it in their rooms and then come to Swami's interview room where Swami was supposed to perform that wedding. Swami sent Mr. Kutumbrao, right? Kutumbrao Garu was one of the very close aides of Swami at that time. So Swami sent Kutumbrao Garu with the sari and dhoti to that couple's house, asking them to wear that and come to Swami's presence. So Kutumbrao Garu went and gave the couple this gift that Swami had sent. Then he looked at the lady and said, Amma, how fortunate you are. How fortunate you are to receive this sari. So she understood that, of course, it is a sari which is coming from Swami. So understandably, it is definitely a blessing to receive anything from Swami. But then Kutumbrao Garu went on to explain. He said, Swami took one full hour to select the sari for you. He said, Swami took one full hour. He pulled out all the saris from the godown and he was... And you know, one sari came out, he said, no, this does not suit her complexion. Another sari comes out and Swami says, no, I gave this to her last birthday. And another sari comes, Swami says, no, this is too grand, she'll feel uncomfortable in this. And then some other sari comes up, Swami says, no, she has 2-3 saris in this color, so let's not give her this. Swami took one full hour to select that sari for that one particular person. How can you be like that, Swami, right? That's the question which comes to our mind. That Swami who has absolutely no desires, no preferences for himself, when it comes to another person's joy, he was there, he was present 100%. It can only be possible because whether or not the wave feels it is part of the ocean knows that every wave is only a part of itself, isn't it? So it is very difficult if we read the description of Stita Prajna and if we feel this seems like a boring person, it's because the Stita Prajna is in the day when we are in the night. We cannot understand this world, but it is our good fortune that we have seen wisdom in action. We have seen detachment in action. We have seen that universal consciousness in action. And it is not boring. It is full of life. It is bubbling and we cannot match that enthusiasm, right? So when we go through this entire description of Stita Prajna, let us not think of somebody who is sitting unmoved and sitting bored. No, there is nothing. Nothing can... There is no sorrow for this person. If I am going to do something for you, if I am going to do something for another person, I will think, is this person worth it? Will this person give back what I am doing? Is it really worth spending my time on this? But for Swami, it was never like that, right? So many of these people whom we have seen Swami giving so much to. Today, sadly, we see that, they are the same people who are hurting Swami and Swami's mission. Sometimes you wonder, Swami, why did you give them so much? But for Swami, it is nothing like that. He was absolutely selfless. So when he gave himself 100%, right? So when we are looking at the state, why did Arjuna ask about Stita Prajna? Why is Krishna telling Arjuna about being a Stita Prajna? Because Krishna wants Arjuna to reach that state. Swami wants us to reach that state. So when we are thinking of reaching that state, let us remember it is not a state where we'll become dull and we'll become morose and we'll become, as Swami would say, a castor oil face. That's what happens to us. A little bit of knowledge that we get, we become a boring person. Sadly so, right? But the one who is filled with wisdom, the one who is like the ocean, the one who is like Swami, be full of energy, will be full of enthusiasm, bubbling, right? So let's keep that image in mind when we're thinking of the Stita Prajna. The Yogishwara is like that. So with that, let's move to the next verse, the verse number 72, which is the last verse of the second chapter. We'll listen to it. I'll give you a brief meaning of that and then we'll discuss about it.
येषा ब्राह्मी स्थितिः पार्थ नैनां प्राप्य विमुह्यति स्थित्वास्य मन्तकालेपि ब्रह्म निर्वाणमृच्छति.
ओ पार्थ, दिस इज द स्टेट ऑफ बीइंग एस्टैब्लिश्ड इन ब्रह्मन. One does not become deluded after attaining this. One attains identification with Brahman by being established in the state even in the closing years of one's life. So there are two things about wisdom that Krishna is saying in this concluding verse of the second chapter. One is a point that he has been making all through, that the wisdom becomes steady. Right? When does the wisdom become steady? We all have these moments of inspirations, you know, sparks of enlightenment and such. But that is not the wisdom that Krishna has been speaking about. He's talking about steady wisdom, right? So Swami would often say this, and I might have mentioned this before too. Swami would ask this question, what is it which comes and does not go? And what is it that when it leaves never comes back? And what is it that neither goes or neither comes? And Swami would explain that jnana, once it comes, it never goes. Ajnana or ignorance, once it leaves, it never comes back. And it is the Atma or the soul which never goes and never comes. So when Krishna is speaking about jnana, when he's speaking about wisdom, he is speaking about that jnana which when it comes, it never leaves, right? And though we are referring to, you know, even in this particular verse, he says, Brahmi Stithihi, the state of Brahman, though we are referring to it as a state, it is more of one becoming something, right? The moment it is an understanding. Once that understanding comes, it never goes, right? Once an optical illusion, once you have been told that, you know, this is the optical illusion, once you see it, you never unsee it, right? That's what they say. Because it has become a part that corrects our vision. It becomes something that changes our perspective. And once the perspective is changed, it's changed. It's changed for good, right? So jnana is something like that. The jnana, at least what Krishna is talking about, is like that. I think in the course of one of the conversations that we were discussing a couple of weeks back or the last week in the afternoon satsang, there Swami very clearly tells Hislop, he says, no, you've never had a glimpse of that state. You're only imagining that. Because if you've really seen that state, your mind will be completely different, right? And that's what Krishna is referring to here. The other point that Krishna is saying here is about holding to that wisdom in the last moments of one's life. Sometime later, I think closer to the 8th chapter, Krishna will explain this in further detail about, of course, there it is more related to being focused on God. Krishna will say that the one who is able to think of me in his last moments will merge in me, right? And we know Swami has also spoken any number of times about this extensively, about having the last thoughts centered on God. But that moment of thinking of God or thinking of the being merged in the Brahman can never be manipulated or manufactured. However much one may try, it cannot be thought of at that last minute. And that is why Swami would say, unless you practice it all through your life, you will not be able to think of God when the time comes. Right? And that is the point that Krishna too will tell in the 8th chapter. But here, Krishna acknowledges in a sense that the thoughts that one has in the last moments is very, very important. And in the case of a man of a wisdom, effortlessly the idea of all of this description that Krishna has been giving, that idea stays till the last moments. Right? And as it is said, of course this is a description which is given elsewhere in Vedanta too. The soul is always stuck to the body as long as the prarabdha karma is there, right? The karma that the soul takes to complete in this particular lifetime. And as long as the prarabdha karma is there, they say the soul will remain in the body. And they say that if a person attains this jnana before the time comes, before the death of that particular body comes, what happens is the soul remains in the body even though it has reached that jnana till the point where the prarabdha is completed and the body is discarded. But here when Krishna says that the ego is completely neutralized in Sthita Prajna, right? And when that happens, when death comes, in a normal person what happens is the Sanchita Karma or the complete bank of karma which is there, that draws the soul back into a fresh body. But in the case of Sthita Prajna, the soul sticks to the body till the prarabdha is there, the moment the prarabdha is completed, the body is given up and the jiva merges with the Brahman and all of the sanchita karma is being completely diluted, completely sublimated, right? And that's what Krishna says in this particular verse. We'll go through the verse again. Krishna says, Yesha Brahmi Stitihi Partha. O Partha, this is the state of Brahman. Na yenam prapya vimukhyati. Yenam prapya. The one who has attained this state, na vimukhyati, is not deluded again. Stitva asyam. Remaining there, antakale api. Even in the last moments, Brahma Nirvanam Ritchati attains Brahma Nirvana or liberation. Another way of looking at this particular verse where Krishna is talking about the last moments is when Krishna says, Stitvas Asyam, if a person reaches that state where he is established in that knowledge, Antakale Api, even if he attains that state in the last few moments before he or she is about to die, Brahma Nirvanam Ritchati, the person attains Nirvana. So it means it is not necessary that one must have lived several decades in the state of Stitha Prajna or Brahmi Stiti, as Krishna is saying in this particular verse, right? And none of us know how close or how far we are from the last moment, right? So it is not necessarily that, oh, you should have become a Stitha Prajna, latest by your 60, and then you should have lived 20 years as Stitha Prajna, and then only you can attain the Brahmi Stiti. No, it is not like that. He says somebody who has reached that state, even in the last moments, can finally merge, right? That's probably one way of looking at this verse. Having said all of this, having come to the end of the second chapter, I think it is important to again go back to what is the context of all this discussion. The context of all this discussion was delusion. Arjuna was deluded. Right? That is how it all started. He doesn't know what is right and wrong. And because he is confused, he doesn't know what action to perform. And in fact, he was about to perform the wrong action. But Krishna tells him what is the right thing to do. But he does not stop there. He also tells him why what he is saying is the right thing to do. And how to do the right thing also, right? That's the most beautiful part. Krishna did not say, of course Krishna did say, go and fight. But thankfully, Arjuna resisted, and that's why Krishna said why he has to fight. And in the process, Krishna gave us a means of, we might all be doing the right thing, but with what attitude we must do the right thing, right? The Buddhir Yoga is what Krishna has given us. Not only doing the right thing by default, not only because there is, if you see most of the advanced countries, there is a very high level of morality. This is not to question the morality of the people, but when being immoral is not very lucrative, I think most people would be happily moral, right? If I don't have to do something wrong and I'm able to get all my conveniences being a righteous person, why will I take the trouble of being an unrighteous person and get into trouble with the law, right? So many people might be doing the right thing by default or by not having a necessity to do anything wrong, but it is not enough doing the right thing, but it is important to do it with the right kind of attitude, right? And that is what Krishna has taught Arjuna in the form of the Buddhist Yoga. And he also tells him why that is right, so he can always keep it in his mind. And then he shows him the entire journey, right? The whole chapter is about the entire journey of, now if you start doing your actions with Buddhist Yoga, you will end up here. You will end up like the ocean. You will end up in the Brahmi Stiti. You will have Brahma Nirvanam, right? It is not that just because, Arjuna, you go and fight, I'm going to give you Brahma Nirvanam. No, that is not what Krishna says. He says, this is how you have to fight. This is the attitude that you must have. This is how you must do your duty. And if you do that, if you keep doing that all through your life, and if you are able to stick to that, you are on course to attain the ultimate goal of life, right? That's what he says. And that is why this entire chapter is the crux of the message of Krishna that he is trying to give through the Bhagavad Gita. And there is no wonder that in Gita Vahini, Swami says this about the second chapter. And this is what I said, I'll give you a quip what Swami says about the second chapter. And Swami says in the Gita Vahini, and I quote, "To people sorrowing on the battlefield of life, bewildered by attractions and distractions, not knowing where to turn and what road to take, Madhava taught this Sankhya Yoga, the path of knowledge." All the other chapters are like commentaries on the teaching of this chapter. End of quote. What a profound thing to say. Swami is saying that this is the crux. The Sankhya Yoga has been taught for the purpose that Arjuna was deluded. And Swami says all the other chapters are merely commentaries of the second chapter. And that is the second chapter we are concluding this week. And thank you all dear listeners for being with me this week and through the many weeks that we have covered the second chapter. As I mentioned last week, it would probably be a good idea to do a summary of the second chapter before we go ahead. I'm not too sure if a summary will take an entire episode, but we'll see how it goes. But nevertheless, I think it would be good for us to quickly summarize the entire second chapter and see the course, because as Swami is saying, this is the crux of the message, so that as we go through the chapters which follow, we will be able to see more clearly what aspect of the second chapter is being explained in those particular chapters. But we pray to Swami that He is with us in every step of this journey, helping us to assimilate and make part of our life this beautiful message that He gave as Lord Krishna, that He further explained as our dear Swami. And as I said, not only did He rekindle this wisdom, not only did He explain this wisdom, but He lived that wisdom in front of us. So even as we go through all of these absolutely esoteric knowledge, which probably might not be applicable to us, you know, it is not necessary that one hearing of the Gita or one reading of the Gita tomorrow we are going to be detached from life. It is not going to happen. Right? It's a long process. So even as we are going through these verses, which may not be directly applicable to us because it is paravidya, it is not easily accessible to the intellectual mind. But let us keep Swami in our mind. He is the Yogeshwara. Right? He is the example of whatever He is speaking here. And He has given us the opportunity to observe Him and learn from observing Him. So offering our, on behalf of all of you, our most humble gratitude to Swami, I conclude this episode. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of the day, the Vahini Satsang. I'll join you all again next week. Till then, take care. Happy listening.